All right, ladies and gentlemen, Crime and Justice Radio. It has been a staple as far as LI News Radio and its programming all since mid-April, and that's where Bruce Barquette, Ida Leisring, The Great Firm, Barquette Epstein, Kieran Aldea Laterco have provided you with some incredible, I mean, every week. There's never a week that's taken off either as far as the guest list. I mean, every week, just prominent figures. And they have done some job. We help kind of preview it a little on a Monday. And we welcome Bruce and Aida to the airways. How are you? I hope all is well for both.
Good morning, Jay. We're doing well.
Good morning, Jay.
Hi, Aida. I'm doing well. Busy Monday, coming off a tough weekend. You know, this Petito case, it has been unbelievable. Aida, I'll start with you from a legal standpoint. I mean, what do you see here as far as ramifications? You know, there's been so many twists and turns as far as the case. Obviously, the discovery yesterday, the body brought to us by the FBI agent Charles Jones yesterday, a little after 6, kind of the culmination of what we were all thinking here. But, you know, you and Bruce are top-flight individuals of the law. Have you scratched your head a couple of times in the last couple of weeks as far as what has gone on here or no?
Listen, we were all glued to our televisions last night with the discovery of her body. They say it's likely her body. It sounds like it is. And I think everyone's just, you know, trying to figure out how this could have come about. Obviously, the world suspects laundry because based on the circumstantial evidence, and that's all we have right now, he was probably the last known person to be with her. We knew there was a domestic situation and tension. He came home without her. He didn't call 911, report her missing or injured. He offered no assistance to law enforcement, and now he's fled. And flight is always deemed consciousness of guilt by law. But at the same time, based on what we know publicly, there's no evidence, really. There's no confession. There's no eyewitnesses to what occurred. There's no discernible motive. For now, there's no telephonic forensic evidence consistent with a murder. A store owner who saw the couple on August 25th or 6th reports they looked happy and shouted that they were engaged. Mr. Laundry doesn't have a criminal record that we know of and no history of violence. And if anything, the domestic violence incident demonstrated that even when Petito became somewhat unhinged, Laundry didn't attack her. Thus far, there's no forensic evidence in the van consistent with a violent crime. But as we all know, we will learn more. We will learn specifically what the cause of death is. We'll learn about the cell site data tower information and what path they took. I'm interested in the text messages, the contents of what she was sending her friends and family, and what he was sending his friends and family, internet searches, GPS, and so forth. It will unravel.
Mr. Barquette, your thoughts, sir, on this?
Well, I mean, it wasn't as much of a mystery to those of us in the business, so to speak. You're kind of hoping for some twist or turn that would make it more interesting, but at the end of the day, it seemed pretty clear and what took place. Hopefully, this man is still alive and he hasn't done anything to himself. But certainly, your thoughts go there, and I think Aida is absolutely right. That the data that we'll get from their cell phones will tell us the path, and I suspect that's how they found her. They knew where she was last transmitting information before he began to make his way back to Florida. So, you know, it's really a sad and tragic situation that's played out over the public, and you got to feel horrible for the family of that young woman. And frankly, for the family of the man, too, whatever happened, it's a tragedy for both families.
From an attorney standpoint, two Long Island-based attorneys, by the way, Rich Stafford, who represents the Petito family, Steve Bertolino represents the Laundry family. You know, I'm not in the business. All I can do is observe. and formulate my own types of opinions and whatnot. Bertolino kind of did what he was hired to do, and that is to protect the rights and everything else of the Laundrie family. You know, hard to say a crime was committed here. You know, I mean, listen, the kid brought the van back on the 1st of September. It was a 17-day gap as far as finally filing a missing person here. From Rich Stafford's point, I mean, is there anything, do you feel, that Stafford could have done differently to press a little bit more? He made response. Was his hands were tied here, basically. I mean, that's all that we have seen. That's all he could have done?
He's just largely a spokesman for the family. There's very little legal work to be done for her family other than to kind of counsel them, offer them some insight, and maybe interact with law enforcement to some degree. You know, he's a former prosecutor, so he probably speaks their language and can provide some insight to the family. The lawyer for Mr. Laundrie, did what he did and opted to proceed the way he proceeded. We'll see how that turns out for his client.
One last thing and we'll move on. Aida, could there have been any type of surveillance on the boyfriend? You know, he came home September the 1st, no Gabby, has the van, made the cross-country trip. You know, listen, I understand from an enforcement point as far as, okay, the guy has rights, doesn't have to talk, didn't talk, family didn't talk. Could there have been some sort of surveillance on him without the legalese of ramifications involved to at least keep an eye on this guy so he didn't flee the scene? And as it turned out, he did flee. Because he basically got a 3-day head start here. So in essence, from a legal standpoint, could that have been altered in any way?
I can't believe, first of all, not law enforcement, that reporters and news folks didn't catch him slipping out the door. They've been planted in front of the house. They're interested to know his whereabouts, what he's doing, who he's talking about. And, you know, it wouldn't be shocking, and I'm sure it's occurred many times in the past, that law enforcement and news reporters work together in that regard, because law enforcement can't violate his privacy rights without probable cause, but they could certainly tail him. So that is really quite shocking that he managed to evade detection. You know, if he had a cell phone at this point, they would be able to determine his whereabouts. I guess you can turn off your GPS data and make sure that you don't text. But, you know, it's really quite shocking, even if he was not a suspect in a murder at the time, because they didn't have confirmation that she was dead and they didn't have confirmation of what, if anything, happened. Somebody should have been keeping an eye on him for the case, but also for his own safety. As Bruce indicated, there could be concerns that he would take his own life.
Look, this is no bones about it. This is egg on the face of law enforcement in Florida. How they let this man disappear while he was clearly the prime suspect in her murder or disappearance is mind-boggling. They didn't have enough to arrest him, but they certainly should have made sure they knew where he was and where he was going. And the fact that they didn't and that he somehow vanished is just, to me, unbelievable.
Now, listen, I've said that throughout the morning. Northport has done a terrible job. I don't want to see this Josh Taylor come up anymore in front of the cameras in defiance. They've done a lousy job. They've given you nothing as far as any of these press conferences. You only may have wished Suffolk County would have been the lead and kept its lead in the investigation, because Northport can't fight its way out of a paper bag. They've done a terrible job in all of this stuff. Really awful. Let's shift gears a little bit, guys. So let's head to tonight. And you got a good one tonight, Rikers Island and everything else. Bruce, give us a little bit of lowdown as far as what we're going to hear.
Well, we learned when we woke up this morning that the 11th person has died on Rikers Island this year, which is just absolutely horrific. The conditions that are being described there are some of the worst that I've ever heard of in any facility in the United States. It is horrible, and we're going to have the head of legal aid, one of the supervisors of legal aid, on to talk about what they've observed there from the attorneys that are going in, and we're also going to talk about the conditions and the soon-to-be closure of the federal facility in Manhattan, MCC, where famously or infamously Jeffrey Epstein killed himself. And we're going to have the head of the Corrections Officer Union to talk about MCC. These two places, MCC and Rikers Island, are the worst facilities for inmate conditions and safety for the inmates and for the guards of any places that you'll find, certainly in the metropolitan area and probably across the country. So we're going to focus on that this evening from two perspectives, the guards and the attorneys representing the inmates.
We knew they were bad. I didn't think they were as deplorable as we hear from Bruce Aida. But, you know, when you look at some of the jail conditions in and around, we focus a lot on the Nassau jail and whatnot. I mean, listen, it's tough when you have to, you know, read about the elements that a lot of people have to live in. I get it. They're incarcerated for a reason. But with that being said, conditions are tough when you read about this with Rikers.
Right, and yes, and the general public sometimes turns an eye. You know, there's so many pressing matters of concern in our day and age today, but they turn sometimes an eye thinking, well, they're in there for a reason, but let's not forget that hundreds of them are there on technical parole violations for missing a curfew or consuming alcohol or being late to an appointment with a parole officer. Our current governor just ordered the release of 191 inmates that are among this sort for the very reason that the conditions are actually quite dangerous, right? People literally die there. They're in mortal danger. And by the way, Jeffrey Epstein did die in MCC. He's not the only person to have actually died in MCC. The numbers are greater than him, but the inmates right now at Rikers, some of them are locked in showers. And I hate to say this, but they're defecating in bags. They're not given food. They don't have places to sleep. There is rampant violence. And maybe some of these individuals didn't have a tendency towards violence, but when you're treated like, I'd say an animal, but I think animals are actually treated better than this. It's understandable why people would be experiencing depression, mental health issues, anger. And it's gotten to the point that sending an inmate to Rikers or sending an accused, someone presumed innocent to Rikers puts them in mortal danger. It's a humanitarian crisis. I understand the governor, has instituted a bill that won't be passed until March to try and prevent certain low-level alleged offenders from going to Rikers in the first place. We will see. Mm. But Tina Longo, just so you know, she's the attorney in charge of the criminal defense practice at Legal Aid Society, which is the largest and oldest defense practice. And they represent, I think, the majority of inmates. So we'll have an inside look at exactly what's going on and what the tours of members of her organization have produced.
You know, you look at the numbers, Bruce, one final thought. You know, the turn of the millennium, the average daily inmate population in city jails was more than 15,500. Fiscal year 2000, 5,722 fight, assault, infractions, 70 stabbings or slashings. 2020, however, there were more than twice as many fight/assault infractions and 75% more stabbing/slashings. Interesting there, because it kind of you know, it's more than a 60% reduction in the average daily population. So, you know, listen, it's something they have to look at without question going forward, especially we've seen this before. But it's something that they're going to have to somehow put in budgets and get these things up to speed.
It's just a question of will. It's simply a question of will. All that is required to run a jail properly is a desire to run the jail properly and to institute policies and guidelines that effectuate that and make sure that the employees do what they're supposed to do and give them adequate staffing and funding to do that. You'll hear tonight from the president of the union at MCC that one of the difficulties they've had there is they don't have adequate staffing to do all the jobs that they're supposed to do. So the guards are literally forced to choose between do we execute this policy or that policy? We can't do both. And he'll articulate that the chief goal is safety for everybody and to make sure that the inmates are fed properly. And then after that, they have to pick and choose what to do and what not to do. The facility there is run down. It's 40 years old. It's overpopulated until they started moving people so they could close it. It was wildly overpopulated, almost twice as many people as was planned for. And they had the inmates in there that the facility wasn't designed for, like El Chapo and terrorists or accused terrorists. It's really quite a problem, and it's simply a question of will. And I think as a society, we need to make this a priority and make sure that we treat incarcerated individuals, especially pretrial detainees, with dignity and in humane conditions. It's horrible that we have to say that, but that's exactly what needs to be done.
I think also, in my estimation, a lot of this is on de Blasio, Aida, because you look at the possibility of Eric Adams taking the reins here. I mean, you know, you want to tell me he could lift the ban on punitive segregation, you know, the solitary stuff, but he must build out the city's jail capacity without question. That has to be first and foremost. And also, you must invest as far as the staffing. I understand. Listen, you must somehow hire quality people, high-quality correction officers. If you're Eric Adams and coming into this post, he has to look at those two things especially, no?
Absolutely. And tonight we will be asking attorney in charge Tina Longo about legal aid correspondences with the mayor's office and what steps or lack of steps they have taken to rectify the situation. With respect to funding, I believe Union President Tyrone Covington of MCC will address that as well, because they'll allocate a certain sum of money, which on its face seems like a lot, but is woefully insignificant, to rectify the problems in that jail. And when you have inmates living with mice, rats, cockroaches, water bugs, and cramped quarters with mold, leaky toilets, unnutritious food, and violence, and temperatures of freezing sometimes or boiling, guess what? Those COs are living in the same conditions for the majority of the day that they're working in that same building. So it's unfair to the inmates. It's inhumane for them. It's also inhumane for the correction officers that are tasked with their care.
But listen, that's a good one tonight. Bruce Barquette, Aida Lyson Ring. Folks, if you have not heard Crime and Justice Radio, you are missing something very, very special. Really great radio, 1 hour. 6 to 7 Monday nights. Rikers Island, the focus here. And we'll look forward to it. Bruce, Aida, thanks so much for a few this morning.
Thank you for having us.